In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and what it is meant for workers, primarily in Mexico. Now, more than 10 years ago, when NAFTA was being debated here in the United States, supporters said that it would create jobs. It would create jobs on both sides of the border as the barriers to trade between Mexico and the United States were taken down. It would stimulate markets in those two countries for goods produced in the other country. And people said that would mean jobs for American workers and also jobs for Mexican workers. As it turns out, it seems not to have quite worked out that way. It has been documented that jobs have been lost in the United States as a result of NAFTA, and that, according to our guest in this hour of Focus 580, the effect on Mexico and Mexican workers has been even more dramatic, even worse. Our guest with the program is David Bacon. He is a journalist and photographer. He is an associate editor at Pacific News Service, has made contributions to publications including The Nation, The Progressive, Z, The American Prospect, and LA Weekly. And he's the author of a recently published book that's titled Children of NAFTA, Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border. His book is published by the University of California Press and does also include some of his photographs as well as some of his reporting. As we talk this morning, we will be happy to take questions, comments. The only thing we ask is that people who are calling in try to be brief, and we ask that so that we could keep the program going, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Bacon, hello.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it. You know, back, I guess it was right about at the beginning of the year, when there was a lot of discussion in the media about NAFTA, we did a couple of programs with someone making the case on both sides, talking about was it good, was it bad. And primarily what we concentrated on in those conversations was what NAFTA meant for American workers. And we really didn't talk very much about Mexico and what it's meant for workers there. So I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk with you. Maybe one thing that you could do at the beginning would be to, if you could, to talk a little bit about how people in Mexico, particularly those people who were advocating for the agreement in the run-up to the agreement when it was being debated, what sort of things were said in Mexico, particularly when people talked about why they thought that it would be good for Mexico? What did they say?
Well, the biggest booster of NAFTA in Mexico was the president of Mexico at the time, Carlos Salinas de Gortari, who's actually now a fugitive from justice. But President Salinas promised Mexicans jobs to begin with. You know, what he said to Mexicans was basically, sure, this agreement is going to lead to the loss of jobs for people in the United States, but we will get those jobs here in Mexico. And these are going to be jobs in modern industrial plants that are going to pay good wages. It's going to help Mexico to develop, to become a first-world country. And as a result, everybody's standard of living is going to improve. The reality was quite different from what President Salinas promised at the time. And in order to understand why that is, you have to sort of take a look at what NAFTA was part of. NAFTA was connected with a whole series of economic reforms that took place in Mexico, which all had one purpose, and that was to create an investor-friendly climate that would encourage large corporations to invest in the construction of factories in Mexico, the famous maquiladoras, or the foreign-owned factories that are located mostly near the border of Mexico and the United States. So what happened is that companies did, in fact, come to Mexico and built factories. And by 2001, there were about 3,000 maquiladoras along the border that employed 1.3 million people. But these factories were all producing products not for sale in Mexico to Mexicans, but products for sale here in the United States. We were the market. So the factories were located in Mexico in order to take advantage of the lower wage level in Mexico, but the products produced by these factories were then taken across the border and sold here. Well, if you remember what happened in 2001 in the United States, we went into a recession. Mm-hmm. So that meant that there were a lot fewer consumers here in the U.S. buying the products of those Mexican factories. And when that happened, those factories started to lay people off. As they say in Mexico, when the United States sneezes, Mexico catches pneumonia.
Yeah. So the argument is that maybe initially that it was good for job creation in Mexico, but in the long term it wasn't such a good idea for them to concentrate so exclusively on one market because the ups and downs in demand in that market, that being the United States.
That's exactly right. There was an unstable source of jobs to begin with because it was dependent on the U.S. market, and also because it wasn't involved in producing products for sale in Mexico. What it led to was a low-wage economy. The Mexican government itself began to have a really big stake in the maintenance of a low-wage economy rather than a high-wage economy. If these factories were going to produce products for sale in Mexico, that would mean that it would be in the interest of the Mexican government to make sure that Mexican consumers, that is workers, were making enough money to be able to buy back the products of those factories. But that was not the case. These were factories producing for the U.S. market. So the Mexican government didn't particularly care about the ability of Mexican consumers to buy the products of those factories because they weren't going to be sold in Mexico. So what that did was, on the one hand, it tied those jobs to the U.S. economy so that when our economy went sour, Mexican workers lost, well, about 400,000 jobs on the border in 2 years. But also, it led to the creation of a low-wage economy in which the whole investment policy, the whole economic development policy being pursued by the Mexican government, and we have to say, too, that this was with the support of our government, too. It wasn't just the Mexican government's idea to do this, that the whole economic development policy was based on maintaining low wages. So just to give you an example, the year the treaty took effect, 1994, the average wage of a maquiladora worker along the border was about $4.50 a day. Today, in Juarez, in Tijuana, in the cities along the border, the average wage of a maquiladora worker is still $4.50 a day. And to give you an idea of what that means now, because prices have gone up in Mexico in the course of these 10 years, a gallon of milk in a supermarket along the border costs about $2. So that means that a maquiladora worker has to work almost half a day in order to buy a gallon of milk for her family.
Mm. So when you look at this job issue and job loss, as you say, that initially in Mexico they said, well, you know, maybe they'll lose jobs in the United States, but we'll get those jobs. So when you look at what happened was here in the United States, depending upon who you ask, I guess, on average people will say, well, maybe about a half a million jobs, something like that, were lost as a direct, we can pin that to NAFTA. And it looks that ultimately in Mexico, the job loss figure was actually fairly close to that. The same thing happened there. So rather than America's loss being Mexico's gain, workers on both sides lost.
That's very accurate. That's exactly what happened. And when you say that the job loss number in the United States was about half a million, I think it's important to note that that's our government talking here. In other words, part of NAFTA was the creation of an extended unemployment benefit system called NAFTA TAA, in which workers who could prove that they lost their jobs because of the treaty were entitled to extended unemployment benefits and retraining money. And the Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor, was in charge of certifying those workers for those benefits. Now, remember that the Department of Labor was itself, under Robert Reich and the other secretaries of labor who followed him, part of the, or they had a stake in keeping that number low because they were the ones who told us when the treaty was being negotiated that it was going to produce jobs here. So these were the people who were keeping track of that number. And as of November of 2002, the Department of Labor itself had certified 507,000 workers for these extended unemployment benefits because the Department of Labor itself agreed that they had lost their jobs due to the treaty. So given the fact that what in effect we had here was the fox counting the chickens, you can imagine that the number was considerably larger than that, that there were workers who never even knew that the program existed or who were disqualified on technicalities or what have you. And that number, that 507,000 number, was so embarrassing that in November of 2002, the Bush administration ordered the Department of Labor to stop counting, because that was when the administration was trying to get fast-track negotiating authority for extending NAFTA to the rest of Latin America. And so having that number out there in public being counted by the government itself was not exactly an argument that was likely to win votes in Congress for the extension of NAFTA to other countries.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Focus 580, David Bacon. He's a labor journalist and photographer. He is associate editor at Pacific News Service. His book is titled The Children of NAFTA, Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border. It's published by the University of California Press, and it is a result of many years of his work as a reporter investigating conditions for workers, Mexican workers, along the border, and to tying that to some of the changes that came about as a result of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement that now is just a little bit more than 10 years old. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that some people, in looking at what has happened with jobs in Mexico, have said that maybe it's not quite so much NAFTA as it is the kind of race to find lower cost places that you can locate your business operations where the wages are less, where your costs are less. The same thing that's happened to American jobs being exported to particularly to Asia, that Mexican businesses have done the same thing. That they have sent jobs out of the country for that same reason, because they can actually cut their labor and their operating costs by outsourcing, locating those jobs outside of the country.
Well, that's true. There is what you would call a global race to the bottom, in the sense that large employers, the ones who are able to sort of move production around the world, kind of go country hopping from place to place to place, looking for those countries where they can cut their labor costs to the minimum. And, of course, the way they do that is by looking for countries where the wages are low, and where also there are friendly governments who will try and do things to keep workers from raising those wages by organizing unions, going on strike, and doing things like that. But, one of the unique things about Mexico is that in many ways the Maquiladora program, which was there before NAFTA, the first maquiladoras were built way back in 1964, so this is quite an old program here. And NAFTA accelerated something that existed before the treaty itself was passed. But this model of developing kind of export-oriented factories, which were located in countries in order to take advantage of the low wages, but whose products weren't going to be sold in those countries to those workers, this was a sort of economic model that was pioneered in Mexico, that was pioneered on the U.S.-Mexican border, and then has been taken to, as you point out, countries in Asia, countries in Central America, El Salvador, Guatemala, Indonesia, the Philippines, and so forth. And there are, particularly in some industries like the clothing industry, companies that go all around the world looking for places where they can cut their labor costs to the bone. And NAFTA was, and the development of the Maquiladora program was sort of the model for doing this.
We have a caller. Let's talk with them in Charleston, and it's line one.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have two questions that might be related. First, you stated that there was a total job loss in Mexico after NAFTA due to the layoffs at the Maquiladora factories, and I don't see how there could have been a net loss unless the Maquiladoras originally resulted in losses of jobs elsewhere in the Mexican economy. And I wonder if you could discuss how that might have happened, and I also wonder if you could discuss the role of agriculture and the migration of of people from the countryside, you know, to looking for factory jobs in this process?
Well, those are excellent questions. When NAFTA was passed, when it went into effect in 1994, Mexico went into an economic crisis that was caused by a kind of a panic among those people who were holding loans that the Mexican government was liable to pay on. And so Mexico devalued the peso that year and then got an economic bailout from the Clinton administration to the order of about $20 billion, which bailed out those people who were holding those notes, in other words, primarily U.S. banks and investors. But Mexican workers along the border paid for that devaluation because their standard of living dropped. And the Mexican economy as a whole that year lost about 1 million jobs. Now, that was more than just the border. That was all over Mexico. Then along with NAFTA and the development of the Maquiladora program, there were other economic reforms that took place in Mexico over the last 10 years. And one of the most important ones was the privatization of Mexican state-owned businesses like the railroads and the airline and the telephone system and so forth, which were all sold off to private investors. And so when investors bought those businesses, they would generally seek to cut their labor costs by trimming the workforce, which again led to another round of layoffs and job losses. So these job losses were going on in the Mexican economy all the time during this last 10 years. So that's going on the one hand. On the other hand, there was an increase in investment along the border, the construction of new factories to employ people, and employment did go up along the border up until 2001. And that was when those factories began to suffer layoffs because of the shrinking market in the United States, which led to the reduction of about 400,000 jobs along the border. So it is a sort of complicated economic picture here. But the basic thing to see in it is that the economic reforms, which included tying the jobs of these border workers to the U.S. market and the privatization and the devaluation of the peso, were all connected to a set of economic reforms which were designed to make Mexico attractive to foreign investors. And that was what NAFTA was part of. NAFTA was also a measure that was enacted in order to make it easy for company owners to move capital and products back and forth across the border. So generally speaking, the job picture in Mexico was pretty bleak, and those promises were not fulfilled that the passage of the agreement would lead to vast increases in employment. On the question of the impact on agriculture, again, one of the things that's been taking place in Mexico as these economic reforms have gone on, which again predate NAFTA, has been that it's become more and more difficult for families to survive in rural Mexico, out in the countryside. For instance, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank imposed on Mexico loan conditions during the 1980s, which included the ending of rural credit so that it became very much more difficult for farmers to get loans that they needed in order to grow crops and to plant and harvest. And then programs that the Mexican government had, which essentially subsidized the growing of corn by small farmers, for instance, and corn being the primary crop grown by small farmers in Mexico, those subsidies were also ended. And the net effect of that was that people were driven out of the countryside and off of their land, both up to the border looking for those jobs in maquiladoras, and of course across the border to the United States as well too. And I think we all remember, for instance, the death of the 14 coffee farmers from the Mexican state of Veracruz who died trying to cross the desert a couple of years ago in a pretty celebrated case of what has become actually a pattern of a lot of deaths along the borders. People seek to come to the United States because in many ways they're being forced off the land where they live. So that's part of what's happened in agriculture, is that it's become more difficult for people to live. Then NAFTA came along, and one of the things that NAFTA did was it removed the restrictions on the importation of corn into Mexico. And, of course, U.S. corn producers growing corn by industrial methods on a very large scale in Iowa and the Midwest are able to sell corn at a much cheaper price than Mexican producers themselves can grow it for in Mexico. And so the importation of corn in Mexico led to the bankruptcy of many Mexican farmers. And it's no accident that the Zapatista uprising started on the first day that NAFTA went into effect. And in Chiapas, Chiapas again is a corn-growing state, and the people who were involved in the Zapatista uprising were generally corn farmers. And so one of the reasons for the uprising was their effort to say that they were going to be driven off their lands and out of their communities because of the importation of cheap corn from the United States into Mexico in the wake of NAFTA. So that was, again, another agricultural effect of the agreement. And the third one was the development of large-scale industrial agriculture in Mexico, especially in North Mexico along the border, which is something that the book tries to document. In fact, the reason why it's called The Children of NAFTA is because of the increase in child labor in export farms in northern Mexico, which were generally set up in order to grow things like tomatoes and radishes and green onions and grapes and strawberries for the U.S. market by large-scale agribusiness, which relocated production from the U.S. to Mexico. So it wasn't just factory work that went to Mexico. It was also agriculture, too.
So American agricultural producers can underprice third world producers, even given the hugely lower cost of labor on you know, these less mechanized but still third world farms where people are working for much lower wages or supporting their family at a much lower standard of living?
That's right. You know, if you go to the Mexicali Valley right below the Imperial Valley in North Mexico or the San Quintín Valley or Maniadero, what you find are U.S. growers, essentially, who are growing things like tomatoes and grapes and strawberries in northern Mexico and paying just a tiny fraction of what the labor cost would be to grow those same crops in the United States. But they're the same growers using the same big industrial agricultural methods to do it. And in fact, the wages that they pay, the piece rates that they pay for the harvesting of those crops in northern Mexico are so low that families can't survive just with the labor of adults alone. And so you go out to the fields there and you see a lot of kids out there working because families are bringing their children out to work because if it's just the adults out there working, they can't make enough to live on.
My question actually related to family farmers in Mexico. I mean, the standard of living of a small family farmer in Mexico, I think, would be so much lower than that of a, you know, an American, you know, either a large family farm or the Americans working for an agribusiness firm, that I find it sort of hard to understand that these family farmers in Mexico still can't undersell American agribusiness in Iowa, given the much higher cost of labor in the United States.
Well, farming, particularly corn farming, which is what we're talking about here, corn farming in the U.S., labor costs are not a really large factor because this is a very, very highly mechanized crop. And so because of the scale on which it's grown and the ability to use these industrial methods, corn can be grown pretty cheaply here in the U.S. You know, again, labor costs aren't a factor. Now, in Mexico, what kept family farmers in business were things like, well, for instance, Mexico had a system that was called CONASUPO. And what this was a series of state-owned stores, essentially, that in every Mexican city, and the CONASUPO agency of the government would buy corn from small Mexican farmers at basically subsidized prices, high prices, in order to keep those farmers on the land, and then would turn around and take that corn and make it into tortillas and sell it in these stores at artificially low prices as kind of a subsidy on food prices for the poor in Mexican cities. And the CONASUPO stores were dissolved and essentially the whole program was ended in the late 1990s, again, as part of these economic reforms that NAFTA was a part of. Well, when that happened, what then took place was that those small farmers in Chiapas or in Oaxaca or out in the Mexican countryside, who, you know, they're just very small, you know, very small plots of land and not able to use, for instance, tractors, or there's, you know, people don't have the kind of capital that's required to buy pesticides and chemical fertilizers, so they can't use those same methods, industrial methods, and they don't have the economies of scale. They were not able to grow corn and sell it at a price that was able to compete with the corn coming in from the U.S. In fact, there were also accusations, to be quite honest, there were also accusations that large U.S. producers were dumping in Mexico in order to be able to capture the Mexican market, and presumably after doing so would then raise prices again to more accurately reflect the real costs of production here. But even not accounting for that, they could still produce more cheaply than, you know, somebody with just an acre or two of land high up in the mountains in Oaxaca or Chiapas without, you know, access to these kinds of modern agricultural methods. So they weren't able to compete. And at the same time, those traditional programs that the Mexican government had in order to kind of help those folks and keep them on the land, they were ended as part of these, you know, economic reforms. So that's kind of what one of the forces, at least, was that drove people into the cities.
I see. But American farmers still get subsidies, don't they?
Yes, they certainly do. In fact, they're probably one of the most heavily subsidized groups of farmers in the world, you know. So that was one of the ironies of NAFTA and the whole free trade system, is that it was supposed to abolish those subsidies. So here we have our government that's insisting on a free market approach around the world, saying that all government subsidies have to be ended, and essentially forcing the Mexican government to end the CONASUPO system. And at the same time, we passed a farm bill, the Bush administration passed a farm bill a year and a half ago that had the highest level of subsidies for American farmers in history.
Well, so, thank you very much for that information.
All right, thanks for the call. This whole, I guess this was one of the things that in some of these programs we did early in the year talking about NAFTA, that we tried to get it. And what makes it very confusing when you're talking about, for example, you ask some kind of question like, well, what does NAFTA mean for agriculture? You can't look at agriculture blanketly as a sector. You have to look at it in pieces and say, well, maybe it depends on what it is, where you are and what you're growing.
Right.
It is true that the Mexican corn farmers just can't compete with corn farmers in Iowa and Illinois. On the other hand, American growers growing things like, I don't know, artichokes, maybe they can't compete with Mexican growers in product grown in Mexico. Now, it might be grown by American growers, but grown in Mexico and then sent back the other way. So you kind of got to ask, well, who are you? What is it you're trying to raise and sell?
Well, I think that's a very accurate description of what's going on, actually. And you do have, you know, this is essentially large-scale industrial agriculture, agro-industrial corporations that we're talking about. And so they move the product across the border depending on where their cost advantage is. So, you know, if they're cheaper producers in the U.S. and selling and want to sell in Mexico, then the corn travels south. And as you point out, if you're talking about tomatoes or strawberries or row crops, then you have, you know, in fact, those same corporations growing in northern Mexico and exporting it into the United States. So it does go both ways. But the key thing to see is how these economic reforms made this possible in a situation in which it wasn't possible before. And again, this was really to the detriment of both Mexican farmers, small-scale farmers, who weren't able to produce competitively, and who then in many cases became wage workers on large-scale industrial farms producing for the U.S. market. So instead of people being sort of independent, you know, family farmers on a small scale, they then became farm workers working at very low wages.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, journalist, photographer David Bacon. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for his book. It's titled The Children of NAFTA: Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border. It's published by the University of California Press. And in the book, not only will you see his reporting, you also see some of his photographs. He is associate editor at Pacific News Service, and contributes regularly to other publications, including The Nation, The Progressive, Z, The American Prospect, LA Weekly. Questions are welcome. We do, though, have the lines full, so if you call right now, you will get a busy signal. Wait until we talk with some of these folks here. The next in line is a listener in Chicago, and it's line 4. Hello.
Hello, very interesting. Whose brainstorm was this? It appears as the Democrats and the Republicans just working the same game. And what is the game here? The game, to me, appears that there will be low wages, no benefits for the majority of the people on the globe. And the ones to benefit would be the internationalists. So we would have royalty and serfs. And it seems that it's working in China. And why? And what will happen to the American workers in the future? Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Bacon, can you make some response?
Well, I think that's a good question. What will happen to U.S. workers in the future? Because in my view, it is a short-sighted policy. Because on the one hand, you know, this system, this new system, really depends on using the U.S. as a market. You know, this is all production in low-wage countries around the world of products that are intended for sale to us here. But if we're losing jobs here as a result of this system, and there's downward pressure on wages here, and one thing that the book points out also is that employers in the U.S. have used the threat of relocation in order to discourage workers from joining unions or for bargaining for higher wages, that really undermines the market that these same corporations are depending on for the sale of their products. So it seems to me it's a system with a very unstable base and a kind of a poor prognosis for a future, because at some point the sale of these products is going to become more difficult. In fact, what happened along the border in the last 2 years with the loss of these 400,000 jobs in Mexico, I think is a kind of a signal of what this system may have in store for it, because you know, when we can't buy as much here, of course, workers pay a big price in Mexico. They lose their jobs. But even the companies that own those factories can't make profits if they're not able to keep those factories running. So the creation of this sort of low-wage system in which, you know, companies go all over the world looking for low wages, I think is a system without a bright future to it, to be honest.
Well, I want to thank the caller. Let's go on to someone here in Urbana, line number 2. Hello. Let's call her there, line 2, Urbana.
Oh, hi. Sorry.
Yes.
First of all, I wanted to say I'm a big fan of David Bacon's work. I'm glad that to have the opportunity to hear him here locally. I wanted to ask, in addition to the loss of jobs and the reductions in the real wages and other things you talked about, my impression, it's purely anecdotal, seems is that working conditions have gotten a lot worse too in Mexico. And I guess I mean mainly health and safety, but probably some other things too. And I wondered if you had to comment on that.
Hello.
Yes, that is true. Just one example of it. There was a very kind of celebrated strike at a plant in Tijuana called Hanyang, which was in which workers were making big shipping containers, the kind that you see on freighters and on the back of big trucks for the Hyundai Corporation. And this plant had a lot of health and safety problems in it, including, you know, pools of water in the floor with big cables running through it to 440-volt electric welding machines, and workers suffering from welding fumes because they didn't have adequate respiration and masks and so forth. And this plant was inspected. Now, again, Mexican health and safety law is actually quite good, and there were Mexican health and safety inspectors who went out to inspect this plant. They inspected it 11 times in 5 years and wrote up citations and took them back to the ministry that they were working for. And basically, all of the citations that they wrote up were put into the circular file by their superiors. And the reason for that was because the Mexican government felt that if they enforced health and safety laws stringently, that that would be a disincentive for U.S. corporations to go to Mexico and invest in the construction of factories. So basically, they discouraged their own employees from filing citations against employers that might cost them a lot of money in terms of improving health and safety conditions. But it is really important to say also that those workers did try and organize and did go out on strike in order to improve those conditions, and were able to get the help of activists in terms of unions and community activists in the United States as well, who went and picketed Hyundai dealerships. And Congress member David Bonnier from Michigan, who was in Congress at the time, even made the issue of these health and safety problems in the plant there and the strike an issue on the floor of Congress, and was successful in pressuring the Mexican government, enforcing the Mexican government to give recognition to their union there. So there's an upside to this as well, too. In other words, that workers have been able to learn how to cooperate back and forth across the border in order to support workers in these factories when they try and do things to improve the conditions there.
Well, that's one thing that I wanted to make sure that we got to, because obviously a lot of people here in this country and in Mexico understand that key to having workers' rights respected, to getting reasonable working conditions and wages, all of that is being able to organize. And there was, in fact, even when NAFTA came into being, there was a side agreement that acknowledged the fact that that was something that would be important, that is, Mexican workers needed to be guaranteed the right to organize. And again, as you say, that's something that American workers realized that it was also in their interest to provide whatever kind of support they could to Mexican workers in the drive to organize. But I get the impression that this experience of the Hanyang workers is maybe not common all over Mexico, and that it hasn't the success of workers organizing, and that organizing then actually leading to something like, for example, increased wages, hasn't really been all that good.
Well, when workers try and do that, they face some pretty high odds and obstacles, because they face a government whose policy it is to essentially keep wages low as a means of encouraging investment. So, you know, the odds are not very good for workers who try and do that. And in a way, I think it's sort of a testimony to the courage of many workers along the border that they have tried to organize independent unions time after time after time, even knowing what these odds were. But I think that NAFTA has also been a school in which workers on both sides of the border have learned that, first of all, they have a mutual interest in trying to learn how to cooperate so they don't get whipsawed against each other. And also, they've been able to learn effectively how to cooperate in order to win some of these fights. So, you know, one example, for instance, is what happened at a clothing factory in the Mexican state of Puebla called Mexmode, where workers were sewing sportswear for Nike at a contracting shop there. They tried to organize an independent union. They got beaten up, fired. A lot of terrible things happened to them. But they were able to get in touch with the AFL-CIO office in Mexico City, and through that office with United Students Against Sweatshops on university campuses here in the United States. And USAS went to Nike Corporation and said, if you don't take a look at what's happening in this factory here and take some responsibility for what's happening to these workers, we're going to set up picket lines in front of college stores that are selling your sportswear. And that was a pretty effective threat, because USAS has a history of doing advocacy for workers' rights, you know, in other situations. And so Nike did send inspectors to this plant in Mexico, and with that pressure the workers at that factory were able to win recognition for their independent union and negotiate a contract with significant wage increases and worker protections there. So in a way, this victory was the product of NAFTA too. In other words, before NAFTA got passed, people were not in the situation where they had to learn these kinds of things. And so for that reason, I think that's why I call NAFTA kind of a school for workers and unions, learning how to cooperate back and forth across the border and learning what each other's problems are and how to support each other.
Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure and check back here with our Urbana caller. Did we get at the question that you were asking?
Absolutely. He actually even answered my next sort of follow-up question.
Okay.
About the upside. It does seem that, you know, that ability to cooperate across the border is a fairly new thing. It hasn't always been that way, and it's one of the it's probably the only good thing that's come out of NAFTA. But I'm really glad he touched on that too. So
all right.
I'll hang up.
Well, thank you. Let's go to another caller here. We have someone in Indiana on our line three, I believe. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You mentioned early part of the answer to the person before this, you used the word essentially, and you were talking about ownership, I guess, of the factories just across the border in Mexico, and you said we're essentially owned by Americans, and I was wondering if you would tease that apart a bit, who is, you know, is the controlling interest in terms of stock or other business instruments used for that purpose, and secondly, do you see anywhere in the future that an administration like Bush would make an attempt to...
Yeah, hold on. Caller, well, hold on a second there. We needed to... One of our lines didn't hang up, and that's where that business signal was coming from. Now we're back with you, caller, Indiana, and you can give us your second question.
Okay. I wonder if there's anything in the future that one could see where an administration like Bush would make attempts in some way to throttle that interest across the border from union to union, if there's any sort of, you know, laws that could be, you know, looked at that way, then pushed that way, and, you know, and actually make it eventually go to a Supreme Court, which is basically on your side. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Very excellent. Helen knows these facts, doesn't he?
Seems so. Thanks for the call. Mr. Bacon, you want to take on that question?
Sure. They're both really great questions. In terms of who the owners of the maquiladoras are, the first thing that's important to say is it's not just U.S. corporations. There are, for instance, a lot of Japanese corporations, Korean corporations. Hanyoung, for instance, was a subcontracting factory to the Hyundai Corporation, which is a big Korean corporation. And one of the reasons why corporations from other countries are locating along the border is because by building factories there, they get access to the U.S. market without paying customs duties and tariffs. So it offers them a big advantage, both in terms of the low wages and in terms of the market access. The U.S. corporations that are involved include some of the largest corporations in the U.S. Just one example, the General Electric. General Electric is a big employer in Mexico now. In 1994, the first year of the agreement, the sales from the GE's Mexican factories totaled $1.8 billion. That's a lot of money invested in Mexico. In fact, Jack Welch, who was the CEO of General Electric up until a couple of years ago and who was fondly known by his employees as Neutron Jack, because if you remember what the neutron bomb was supposed to do, it was supposed to, when it went off, it was supposed to kill people with the radiation but leave the buildings intact. Well, Jack Welch was known as Neutron Jack because he hollowed out GE factories in the United States by laying off the workers and leaving the buildings intact. And Jack Welch said that the future of General Electric as a corporation lay in Mexico. Delco. AC Delco is now the largest employer in Mexico. General Motors is a big employer along the border. Lear Industries, auto parts industries, are big employers as well, too. Sara Lee, the clothing manufacturer, employs thousands of workers there. So some of the largest manufacturing corporations in the United States are among those who own factories along the border there, producing for the U.S. market. In terms of the second question, what the Bush administration is likely to do if it's reelected in November in terms of stopping this cross-border movement, You know, that is a very a question I think should cause a lot of concern, because the Bush administration's policy towards the border itself has been to basically try and prevent the free crossing of workers, clearly, but also the exchange of information and activity between unions and workers in both countries. Whether they're likely to invoke provisions of the Patriot Act or of border control legislation in order to stop this, it's kind of hard to predict, except that, you know, we obviously have an administration that is pretty hostile towards unions in general. And so, you know, it's not, I think, a far stretch to think that, you know, their hostility towards this kind of cross-border activity would increase in another administration, for sure.
Other callers here. We've got about 5 minutes left. We'll see how many we can get in. Urbana next, line one. Hello.
Yeah, there was a recent Bureau of Labor Statistics payroll survey that showed that since between November 2001, when the recession ended here, and November 2003, on average, wages have fallen 21% when you look at the contracting industries compared to the expanding industries. So, and in Illinois, the figure was, it dropped 34%. That was recently pointed out by ABC. So we're not doing so hot either, which is kind of ironic. But I just wanted to ask you if there seems to be a lot of economic lessons that could be derived out of the NAFTA experience so far. And I know that in Mexico, I just recently read an article called Seven Myths About NAFTA out of the Science, Technology, and Development Program of University College of El Colegio de Mexico. But I was wondering, is there anybody on our side of the border who has kind of wrung out what all this means and just how bad the whole idea was in the first place? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, yes, there is. As a matter of fact, one of the people who studied NAFTA the most is Sarah Anderson from the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and they have produced two very important reports, one 3 years ago called NAFTA 7, and then a more recent one, NAFTA 10, which, first of all, tries to get at the real numbers, for instance, in terms of job loss. Even though, you know, the Department of Labor, as we said at the beginning of the show, counted 507,000 workers who had lost their jobs here as of November of 2002, the IPS and the Economic Policy Institute, also in Washington, have estimates that are much higher than that for the actual job loss. But they've also taken a look at what the impact of NAFTA was on union bargaining, on the ability of workers to form unions, sort of tried to assemble a complete picture of what NAFTA's effects are. And so Sarah Anderson and these reports are really important ones for people who are interested in kind of making that assessment.
We'll try real quick to go to Chicago here, line four.
Thank you. I'd like to ask, what can we as individuals, or how do you see an answer to all of this situation? And the thought that came to my mind is we're digging our own grave.
Well, it's that's a good question, and this is an election year, and especially during the Democratic primary, while there was still some competition among Democratic candidates for the nomination, there was a lot of discussion of NAFTA and trade policy. Since basically Kerry has become the inevitable nominee, there's been a lot less discussion of it. But I think that in terms of the way people participate in this coming election, both as voters and as going to candidates' forums and talking with people who are up for election, that these questions ought to be out there, that, that all candidates from whichever party should be asked about what they think about NAFTA and the idea of extending it to other countries in Latin America and U.S. trade and economic policy generally, that this is something that anybody can do. And the other thing is to sort of take a look at those situations that come along where we become aware of labor struggles in Mexican factories and those workers appeal to us to not buy the products of those companies or to support them in one way or another. There are Maquiladora support networks in Chicago, in Kansas City, and all over the country. There are groups involved in supporting Maquiladora workers, and you know, that's another way in which people can participate and help.
And there we must leave it. Our guest, David Bacon, journalist, photographer. The book is The Children of NAFTA, Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border, published by University of California Press. Mr. Bacon, thank you very much for talking
with us. It was my pleasure to be with you.